Yeah, I've been in coal for Chiratna since 1983 here in Bristol. And at that time, I was running a business importing herbal products from India. And that was going all right, but it wasn't going brilliantly. And then I started to develop this strong feeling that I wanted to do something else with my life, something that involved helping people. That was it. I think it may have been inspired by my coming across this, the Bodhisattva ideal, which no doubt you've all heard of. And it seemed, it was a bit of a crisis at the time. It seemed like most of what I was doing and what many people did for a living was, didn't amount to much, really. It was sort of materials, it was consumerism, what's the point of it kind of thing. I'm sure there is a point to all these things, but what really I felt that mattered, given my life more meaning, was helping people, doing something, I suppose, to help alleviate the suffering there is in the world. So I ended up, for some reason, choosing social work as a career. So social work is not an easy sort of occupation, really. What I sometimes have, I come across, or I have social work students, and my same advice I give to them is that the biggest challenge of social work is not strangling the people you're supposed to be helping. I say this sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, and it's not very Bodhisattva-like, but the reality is quite a bit different to the sort of ideal, but then that's the case with a lot of things, really, isn't it? So I took social work training, which was then a diploma, two-year course, back in early 1990s. And I started my first job, which was in child protection. I've chosen to work with children and families. I started in child protection with the local authority in 1994. And I managed to survive that for about seven years. And it was very tough. I found it extremely challenging, and it still is today, really. So then I got into fostering instead. But just to go back to social work, you probably have an idea of what social work is. The different sorts, but the British Association of Social Workers states, defines social work as, social workers work with individuals and families to help improve outcomes in their lives. This may be helping to protect vulnerable people from harm or abuse, or supporting people to live independently. Social workers support people, act as advocates, and direct people to the services they may require. Social workers often work in multi-agent, multidisciplinary teams alongside health and educational professions. So that's one definition. But I mean, it has been said that social work is, in a sense, a sort of sticking plaster on society. That it's sort of, if we had a more sort of better or more perfect society, we wouldn't really need much in the way of social work. And that what social workers do is deal with sort of the problems that are out there in society. People that aren't coping, the people that are coming to some sort of harm or at risk of harm. And we get quite bad press as well, you may have noticed, as being sort of interfering do-gooders, which is not particularly inspiring, but as a social worker I kind of take that on the chin, really. So social workers undergo training which covers quite a large range of theories and methods, like behavioural theories and systemic theories and advocacy, empowerment, anti-oppression. We draw from psychology, from legal stuff, from political studies, sociology. But these things are not covered in tremendous depth. There's just each one is a subject you could do a degree or PhD on in its own right. So we sort of pick a bit from each and sort of explore it. But I would say that it's more like a taster, really. But some people decide to take certain aspects further, look into it further. But my feeling is that over the years, for a long time, really, that these, a lot of these theories and methods, they kind of have an overlap with the Dharma. Basically, that people are subject to, and in a sense, victims of conditions, and that it's very hard to change, but that change is possible. So it's a little bit like Dharma practice. You can see the vision, you can see what works, and that there is sort of a hope. But actually doing it is a bit more difficult than you might have expected. Yeah. So Yeah, around the year 2000, after about 7 or 8 years in child protection, I joined a fostering agency, and I'm still in fostering to this day. So you may or may not know, I expect most people have some idea of what fostering is, but it's really when foster carers look after other people's children because the parents of the children are either unable or not allowed to look after themselves. Taking children and putting them with foster carers. It goes back a long time. There's always been foster care, but in a rather more sort of informal fashion, probably throughout history, really. But it became more formalised, I suppose, since around the war, maybe just before, I'm not sure. And we had all those children that were evacuated in the war. That was a kind of fostering, you know, children taken out of the cities because of the bombing, and they went to live on farms or in the countryside where they were safer, and they sensed they were with foster families. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty unregulated. So foster carers, to become a foster carer, you have to undergo a lengthy assessment process and some training before you then become registered as a foster carer, and then you have children placed with you that you look after. The children who are fostered, who go into foster care, have often experienced abuse and or neglect, which has had an impact on them. And so that they don't respond in the way to the care given that the foster carer's own children may have responded. They're different. And we do make a point of telling them this, that it's parenting, it's looking after children, but it is quite a lot different to looking after your own children. So your experiences you've had of looking after your own children are useful, but they're not the complete story. And it doesn't matter how much you explain that. I think that fostering usually comes as quite a shock to foster carers when they start fostering. That first year is a steep learning curve, as they say. So we provide, the agency that I work for provides, you know, it recruits foster carers, it assesses them, it provides support, guidance, training. And actually, interestingly, in the last year or so, the training has included mindfulness as well, which, when I ask around, carers seem to enjoy. I've not been doing the training myself, but I might do. But you know, there's a whole day's training in mindfulness, which they find very useful. So attachment, that was one of the things I thought I'd talk about a little. You have this thing called attachment theory, which says that it's very important for a child, especially when they're very young, when they're a baby, to have a figure that's a reliable and consistent caregiver, someone that they can rely on and they can become attached, they can kind of trust. This is really from birth, you know, it's really important. And the baby then knows its needs will be met, and this creates a kind of secure base for them to develop. You know, if they don't have their needs met so well, then they kind of, I suppose they think, if they think that the world is not a very safe place and it's all a bit scary and it's all a bit unreliable, and you know, they don't cry and then somebody comes and sorts them out, they just cry and cry and cry and they don't get enough to eat, those sorts of things. That has quite an impact on babies. Can't underestimate this idea of attachment. The best analogy, metaphor that I heard was, it's a bit like a baby monkey clinging to its mother. You know, you might have seen on the wildlife documentaries a mother monkey climbing through the trees really high up in the rainforest, and the little baby just clinging to the underside of that mother. You know, it's holding on for life, you know. And if it let go, I mean, it would fall and die, no doubt. So it's a bit like that. Babies need attachment, like they need food or air. It's absolutely essential. You know. So if they don't have this sort of opportunity, then they can develop, their brain develops differently, and they can develop what we call attachment disorders. That's a sort of a psychiatric thing, really, that you can diagnose. But I think we all have some sort of attachment disorders, probably, or attachment style, whether it's been diagnosed by a professional or not. So I see this as a kind of cause and effect. You know, you're seeing the effect later in life of something that happened much earlier. Yeah. So there's a sort of connection with the Dharma, really. And I suppose that most of you, if you've been practicing Dharma for a while, have come to think about your own sort of background and your conditions, your upbringing, perhaps. You know. I know I have, you know, it sort of happened fairly spontaneously. It was sort of like a therapy, really. And it still goes on to some extent. I mean, when I was a baby in the late 50s, I think it was the predominant way of parenting was probably, you know, that you had to train babies, you know, and you could spoil them if you pandered to them. Then they would not understand, no respect for you, they would think that they were in charge, that they would, you know, be spoiled, that they would have, you know, they'd just be a bad person. So the idea was that, you know, you sort of, it was very conditional, the idea to be conditional, so that if they cried, you know, you sorted them, but they kept crying, then you just left them, because they have to learn that that was not the way to run the household, you know. I mean, it sounds bizarre, you know, I mean, things have changed since then, I hope, but that's the way it used to be. So I kind of don't blame my parents, because that was the prevailing kind of way at the time, really. Yeah, you go through this blaming parents thing, but, you know, they're only young, so what do they know? And there's no training to be a parent, or is there, really? So you could have, perhaps you've done that yourself, worked it out, you know. Hopefully you have, or you're well on the way to doing so. So I think I have a kind of anxious, ambivalent attachment style, which means that I'm sort of... I feel trapped, but I also like taking risks as well. You know, I feel sort of my need for attachment means that I'm kind of a bit worried about sort of stepping out of my comfort zone. But on the other hand, I will just fly out of my comfort zone as well, which is a bit contradictory. But that's a bit what I'm like, really. So yeah, humans in general, I think, have this strong for a sense of security. You know, even if the universe is not really like that, as we know, it's constantly changing, that life is a process, and that in a sense there is no, in samsara, there is no security, reliability, you know. As T.S. Eliot said, you know, humankind cannot bear very much reality, you know. But maybe you can bear more reality if you're kind of had a stable base, if you're kind of, in Buddhist terms, you've done enough samatha practice, you know, you've sort of integrated enough. And then you can look at, you know, the way that the world really is changing and how it all is sort of unstable and impermanent, you know, and that's sort of okay, rather than being really quite scary and sort of undermining. You know. So back to fostering. Research says, has found, that the children who've been in the care system can generally have poor outcomes later in life. Now, not always, you know, at all, but... sort of, if you look at homeless people or people with drug problems or people in prison, mental health problems, you know, you'll find that there's an over-representation of children that be in the care system, you know, for whatever reason, because of the damage that they've had, you know, but also the attempts to help them heal through the care system have not been enough, or, you know, they've been unlucky or whatever. So part of my job is to support foster carers, look after the children that are placed with them, to support them. Many of these children have what we call challenging behaviour, which is an interesting phrase. Yep. They have challenging behaviour. So, for example, they get excluded from school, they run away, they have trouble regulating themselves. In other words, they can lose their temper and be verbally or physically violent. Tend to get involved with drug taking, smoking weed mostly. They can damage property in the foster carer's home. They get in trouble with the police. All that. So sort of bread and butter of my business really is helping foster carers manage that. Yeah. So foster carers need certain qualities, I'd say, to do the job. Two of them came first to mind were patience and energy, which happen to be, you know, two of the perfections of Bodhisattva, Kshanti and Virya, interestingly. I dare say they could do with all 10 perfections, that would be great, you know, but just those two would help. You know. And they also need a sense of humour as well, I think, which is a kind of not taking it all too seriously. Seeing, that, you know, in a sense it's being perhaps a bit playful. You know, they say that the Bodhisattva doesn't sort of work in the sense they play when they help, you know, it's like, to them it's like play, you know. I'm kind of building up foster carers to be something really special, which they are, but on the other hand, they're just normal people like the rest of us, you know, who have that desire to make a difference, to help. You know? So sometimes they struggle with behaviour, and this is where social workers come in, or I come in. So I give supports, and that support, I suppose, takes forms such as I give advice, I listen. Often foster carers just want to unload, they just want to let out, you know, all the stuff they're bottling up. And that can be a bit scary, because it's like part of me just wants to fix it all and make it right, you know, has a fear of things going wrong. But I've learned, you know, that it's okay just to sort of allow that process to happen, you know, let the carer just sort of offload and then do something, you know. It could be practical support. We offer training. I suppose helping them to try and reflect and understand the child better. Again, it's a kind of cause and effect. So the foster carer's got a child that exhibits some very challenging behaviour, and part of enabling them to, say, both tolerate that behaviour and kind of to try and change that behaviour. So I would talk about the experiences that we may know about that the child has had in their past, of what they've been through. It kind of helps. It's a kind of forgiveness thing, you know. How can you really be upset or angry with somebody that when you know that, you know, there's lots of reasons why they're doing what they're doing, that they're not doing it just to hurt you. That's the thing, isn't it? You know, they're not doing it at you, they're just doing it, you know. You could be somebody else. It's not personal. It's not, don't take it personally, I have to say. Don't take it personally, you know, easily said, but, you know. So there's lots of ways I try to sort of help foster carer how to make it work, how to make the foster placement work, you know, how to make it continue. That's the thing, that's the goal, really. And one of the further things that came into my mind when thinking about this was, for some time I've been thinking about, is views, you know, that people have views. Yeah, in Buddhism we understand that there are views, you know, there's sort of right views and wrong views, putting it sort of simplistically, really. But I think it's more than just that. I think that we are sort of, people tend to be defined by their views, you know. It's the views are the ways that people understand and make sense of the world. It can be political views, views about what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad. It's kind of usually a judgment involved with there, and it's a kind of a way of fixing the world and a way you can handle it. Yeah, I got that sorted, I understand that, that's good, that's bad, this is that, that's that, it's sorted. Great, you know, I can sort of... but these views, whether they're very consciously or unconsciously held, I think they can be restrictive and unhelpful to people. As we know, you know, they are to people, because we have to work on our views as Buddhists, you know, to develop sort of right view, perfect vision. Mm-hmm. So, but the, you know, the tendency to have views is quite strong, and I think that's part of how people create the security that they crave and need in a very scary, sort of unpredictable universe, really. Having views is a kind of way of almost kidding yourself that you've kind of got it sussed, until something comes along and shows you that you haven't. But meanwhile, you can kind of have a little breather, you know, got it worked out. I'm always suspicious of people who will have certainty, I suppose, particularly, say, in the fostering arena. If I go to visit some people who are interested in fostering, and they seem to have strong opinions, it's like an alarm bell to me, you know. I remember one chap once said, well, you know, we're really good parents, everything, do everything, you know, we sit down at 6 o'clock, round the table, we have a meal, you know, that's what we do. And I think, you know, on one hand, yeah, that's great, but on the other hand, some of these children have never done that, you know, they wouldn't know how to sit at a table, they wouldn't use a knife and fork, possibly. They wouldn't sit still long enough. There'd be a lot of problems in that simple thing about getting the family to sit round a meal at tea time. And if that, you know, if they're expecting that, you know, how flexible can they be with that sort of routine, you know? They have to be flexible, very flexible. So, a little alarm bell goes off in my head when I hear people talking like that. This is what we always do. Well, this is, you know, it's sort of like, oh dear, you know, okay. So it's about changing habits, you know. Another thing that we have to do, we learned in Buddhism, we have to change our habits, you know. So they need to be flexible, and carers' views can get in the way of sort of caring for a child. So in my work, really, what I have to try and do, I've realised, is to try and get people to let go of their fixed views. I also have to be aware of my views, and I have to be aware about my views of their views as well, really, you know. So we've all got views, that's the way it is, you know. So I feel that views tend to be created by conditions and feelings, generally, maybe other factors as well. But they're a big part in how we create a sense of self, which we know for the Dharma, we know that there is no self as we understand it. But I think views are a strong part of how we define ourselves. Yeah. To weaken those views or to examine those views is quite useful in a way of, you know, if you want to change, if you want to grow. So, but I think letting go of, getting foster carers to let go of views or change views, it's quite, you know, in a sense, quite a big ask, really. It can be quite a struggle. And I'm never completely sure that I've got the answer, that I know what views that they should have, you know. But it's good to be curious and to hold views in a provisional way, just lightly, and be ready to take on another idea, another way of seeing things. I think that's really important. So yeah, views can be changed, I think, through reflection and by developing awareness. And my role, in a way, is to help them with that. In a sense, I'm asking the foster carers, as I said, to become bodhisattva-like, to constantly put the child before themselves, to keep examining their views, to let go of their expectations, and repeatedly forgive and start again, and start again, and start again. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a lot of commitment, you know. A lot of these children want to know that it's not conditional. Whatever they do, they're not going to have to move. The foster carer is not going to give up on them, you know. That's what they really need to, not just be told, but to feel that that is the case, that this is the last foster placement, because children do move sometimes a lot, you know, because their behaviour is too difficult, mainly, and you know, they move on, you know. Sometimes they end up in residential units, you know, which is not always the best thing. So yeah, I'm expecting them to do all those things. It's and I try and do this. It's about helping them to reason, by sort of teaching them, helping them to reflect, and really, where the relationship I think that I have with them. And I think every social worker has a different way of relating, forming relationship with carers. But I need to get some trust and respect between me and them, and. I do that with a variety of people. There are people that I would not choose necessarily to have relationships with or be friends with or even sort of spend any time with at all, really. You know, these are people that have been sort of allocated to me, you know. And I think there's a bit of an art in doing that, you know. Some people are very, very different to me. And my feeling is they're at different places. Some carers get it, you know. And some carers sort of don't, you know, and you're starting from different ways when it comes to understanding attachment, being flexible with views, forgiveness and all those other qualities, you know. A lot of them, the heart's in the right place, but they're not yet anyway. So some carers are easier to work with than others, I say. And the goal is to help the carers change, which in turn helps the children change, so that the children can go through kind of a healing process and go to live a happier, more stable, successful adult life. So they do need to form attachment with their foster carers. It's a really big thing. So, yeah. So I've been a social worker for about 23 years. I've been a team manager for many years, and then I had redundancy, which was interesting and challenging, more than I expected, because I found myself sort of floating for about 6 months, feeling that I kind of lost a massive part of my identity or self, you know, more than I ever expected. I didn't think it would matter, but you know, I sort of didn't, you know, like, who, what do you do? Like, oh, nothing, you know, who are you? Well, I'm not sure, you know, it was kind of like that, you know, for a while. So that was a bit horrible and a bit interesting at the same time. It was a learning experience, really. And what else? Besides actually supporting foster carers, that's part of my job, and the other part of my job is I'm an independent reviewing officer, which means that I chair foster carer reviews. Every year, every foster carer has to have an annual review where we look back at the year, see how they've done, whether there's been any problems, and ultimately whether they're okay to continue fostering. So I do about 100 of these in a year, and it's... it's interesting. It's sort of dipping in and out of people's lives and the dramas and hearing the stories, you know, and seeing where people perhaps, I mean, sometimes it's because people have had complaints or allegations against them, or you know, there have been difficulties and things. It's Generally, you know, the more dramatic it is, the more I enjoy it, actually. It's the straightforward ones I find rather tedious, actually. But I do that, and I have some foster carers that I look after personally as their social workers. So it's a split role. And I really don't have, at 60 years old, any ambition to sort of change or do anything much, really. More, I'm quite happy with what I'm doing. I seem to have a sort of niche. I recently had the opportunity to go for a promotion and was encouraged to do so, but on reflection, and there were different voices telling me different things inside my head, I just thought, well, why would I do that? I'm quite happy with what I'm doing. You know, why would I want to be more involved in the organisation and management? I actually like what I'm doing. So I didn't, and I felt quite happy with that. And I suppose the main thing is that so far I've not actually strangled anybody. So that's me, really.
Well, thank you, Chittamani.
It's
a pleasure.
Does anyone have any questions for Chittamani?
I have one. Quite early on, you said something about a vision, or like having hope. Always, there's always hope that people can change, and you have a vision of what is possible.
Yeah.
I was just curious, what helps you maintain that vision?
Yeah, good point. Actually, yes. I suppose, besides the fact I need to run money as my career, the fact I need to do and continue doing it because of that is one practical sort of way. I suppose that it sometimes goes well, it works, you know, and it gives me a lot of fulfillment. You know, there's a lot of times it doesn't work and I feel quite let down or frustrated or upset. Social work can be a bit of a thankless task. I mean, very rarely do you get thanked by anybody. You know, clients, people trying to help. I'm not saying it applies to everybody, maybe it's just me, I don't know, but people don't often say, you know, oh, really, you know, that's great, I appreciate that, thank you for the help. You spend all day, like, helping people. And I'm often amazed at the way people just sort of soak it up. You know, it's like, but that's what we do. You know, that's what I signed up for, really. You know. But it does work, and there's little things that give me satisfaction, that keep me going, that keep the vision, as it were. Sometimes there's little things that I enjoy. I can be very critical, but I like to see the good in people, and I can do that. Even when it's you know, somebody's got, I can see that they've got a lot of limitations or faults, there is some good. I think it's very important. I say that to the foster carers, you know, that they've got to find something in the child that they like, even if the child is very challenging, you know, and abusive. They've got to like something about them, otherwise it just won't work. And to like somebody, then you just have to look long and hard enough, really, you know. And then you know, something, you get an effect. You can't sort of tell yourself to like somebody, you have to find something, really, that you like. You know? So it's often little things, you know, that keep me going.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I was quite really interesting. I wondered if you could say maybe a few more words about the views. I found that point quite interesting. So how you, the kind of like linkages that you made there.
Yeah. See, to me it's strange, you know, the social work theory, I mean, a bit like the Dharma, there's lots of sort of lists and stuff, and it just goes on and on, but you know, you sort of walk away with something. But it's a bit like the Dharma, you know, I've done all the study, and but I can't say I've got a head full of sort of Sanskrit terms and lists. It's just, you know, I'm just not built like that, really. It's more of a nondescript kind of thing, the Dharma in my head or wherever it is. And it's a bit like that with social work practice. You know, it's interesting, we have Dharma practice and social work practice. It's up there with practices, which I quite like, actually. Yeah, views. I just feel that, you know, that people are mostly made of views, or bundles of views, you know, sort of a personality is constructed from views, really. It's like making a stand on something or having a judgment about something, you know. And to not do that, to not make a judgment, is in some ways more difficult. You know, you have to be much more confident to be able to hold different ways of looking at something in your head, I think sort of the easy way really is just to make up your mind what you think is, you know, good or bad, or what you think is right or wrong, and it's sorted, you stick to it. You know, ideally you just have like a book, you know, mentioning no names, you know, a book tells you all that information and it's all sorted, it's brilliant, you know, end of problem. You know, I don't think that's very realistic really, you know, that's not what it's about, you know. I suppose likewise, you can't tell, you know, every situation you get in fostering is different. There may be similarities. You may come across a child that's doing certain things, acting in certain ways, and think, oh, that's just like the other one, you know, a few years ago, yeah. But it's not. They never are, not completely, you know. They've always got to have that room for doubt, I think. Not masses of doubt, so it's kind of crippling, you know, obviously. But to hold views sort of quite lightly and to re-examine them and revise them as you go on. But I think part of the job is noticing you've got them, really. Noticing you've got views, you know, because they're sort of like the wallpaper of your mind. And they're just there, you know. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. Thank you, yeah.
I'm sure I could say a lot more, you know, if I prepared better. But you'd be the whole thing on views, couldn't you?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Smiley. Right. Much appreciated.